Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Reptile Ramblings. I'm your host, Nate. And as always, I'm joined by
Brian McDowell here.
And today we decided to do a little something special, do a little Costa Rican snake review, just a deep dive on a few of the snakes down there, and along with some other snakes that Brian's seen in his time that are maybe not the same species, but in the same genre as what I saw down there.
Yeah, colubrids, colubroid. You know, at this point, we're going to have a different name for our podcast, but that's probably already taken, huh?
Yeah, I think someone beat us to it by like 50 episodes.
Shucks. But yeah, man, yeah, it's going to be kind of a species-rich kind of episode, just a deep dive. Because, I mean, we could talk about snake species all day, and we still wouldn't get through what we want to talk about. But we got a nice sampling to show you guys.
Yeah. So I think we'll start off with the snail eaters, which are the genus Siboney, which is a pretty widespread genus throughout a lot of Central America and into Northern South America.
Yeah, even Mexico.
So most of the, I guess, warmer parts of Latin America.
Latin America, North America. I mean, really, it's like the one species, and you could touch on this one, the cloud snail eater?
Clouded Siboney nebulatus.
Yeah, that one's has a wide geographical distribution from, like, I think southwestern, southeastern Mexico all the way down to like Colombia, Ecuador. So
I've even heard of them being in Peru. So
yeah, it's a very broad range for species.
Yeah. And the thing about Siboney is they're generally arboreal, though you might see someone like crossing the road or something like that. But like, most of the time, if you're hiking at night, from what my experience, which granted is pretty limited, but my experience is almost always kind of like at eye level, maybe 5 feet above or 5 feet below eye level in the trees or in the shrubbery at night. They see them.
At night, though. So, I mean, they are nocturnal. And maybe, you know, in the daytime, they're probably tucked away in some tree nooks or higher in the canopy, something like that.
Yeah. But speaking of the cloudy snail eater, that was actually the first snake I saw in Costa Rica.
Yeah, your first snake. I remember. I mean, they're pretty, man. They're pretty looking.
Yeah.
It's mainly the eyes that get me.
I mean, it really does look mottled.
I mean, no, it's like the freaking galaxy, dude.
Yeah. That right there, that's what you see when you lick the toad.
Toad, and then what is it, the frog, like frog eggs and whatnot. It kind of a generalist. I mean, that's probably why it has such a broad range. It's kind of a generalist in the Siboney genre.
Yeah, whereas the other ones tend to be a bit more, you know, snail specialist almost.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, kind of the same with the Imatodes, you know.
Yeah, Imatodes is a pretty arboreal tropical generalist.
And, you know, we touched on it too, but they feel like nothing. They don't feel like anything. They're so light and dainty.
Yeah. Like I said before, it feels like how to put it.
It's so thin it could curl around one of your fingers.
Yeah. And it's like a 2 foot long snake.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I found one in Panama at night. And, you know, it was a long snake. It was about a meter. It's like 3 feet, but yeah, like just tiny, tiny in terms of like girth. Just, and apparently they eat a lot of anoles. So, which makes sense. You know, they're so thin and weightless. So they probably don't make much of a ripple effect when they go along the ends of branches and whatnot.
Yeah. Cause you know, anoles, they love clinging onto the tiniest, thinnest little branch just sleeping there.
Yeah. So,
it would make sense they had to be really lightly built to A, hold on to those and be balanced on those thin branches, and B, not disturb it too much so that it wakes up your potential prey item.
Exactly. So, I mean, evolution at play. And it's cool you got to see, you know, sleeping anoles. I think that's so cool.
Yeah. But speaking of Siboney, I actually saw a total of 3 species of Siboney as far as I can count down there. We actually saw 2 in one night. First time I saw 2, which first one was obviously the cloud oats, which those are everywhere. Those probably the most frequently seen snake on my trip.
Right.
But then the second one, it was the mottled snail eater, which is Siboney longifrenus. Let's see if get this picture pulled up. That
was kind of like a garden phase looking thing. Like, it was really interesting looking, the coloration. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost a little bit of mimicry with the eyelash, because, you know, some phases of eyelash vipers have that kind of color.
Yeah. Yeah, that is pretty, very modeled. I really do like how that orangish color matches and is modeled with the greens on the backside, the dorsal side.
Yeah, I mean, a tropical rainforest, I mean, you would probably lose that thing in a heartbeat, I bet.
Yeah, which probably is why we saw it at night, because that's A, when they're moving around, and B, because you're using, you know, artificial lights, it kind of makes it stand out a little bit more versus natural daylight designed to blend in with that.
Right. And so, look, so I can't really, I mean, I probably could pull up my Google Doc, but I remember this one note I added. So it's from, I think, Herp Journal, or one of the journals regarding herpetology. And so these guys, they field collected a big blacktail crebo, and, you know, in the process of doing so, regurged some prey items. And one of those prey items was the clouded snail eater.
Had to be on the ground, because crebos aren't known for going up trees too much.
Probably had to be the ground, probably in the daytime, so it was probably caught lacking, for lack of a better term, you know.
Yeah, it's like man, I can smell a lot of snails in that tree just across the road. I just gotta risk it. Then ran the wrong side of the snake equivalent of a freight train,
or, like, you know, South America's equivalent of the king cobra, basically.
Yeah,
so that was an interesting note, that, you know, it was a prey item for king of all snakes, in my opinion, but
at least neotropical snakes.
Yeah. But like you said, it's a specios genre. I forgot how many in Costa Rica. I think around 7 or so.
Like, yeah, let me do a little count to the book, which, by the way, the book is...
Yeah, promoted.
Yeah, it's Reptiles of Costa Rica by Twan Leenders. I'm guessing that's a Dutch name. But, yeah.
I forget, man. Did I recommend that to you, or you found
I think
that?
You did. I think okay. You did.
Yeah, because I saw it on Amazon. It was a good price. And, yeah, it's very very handy. And it's a good size. Like, I haven't bought it myself, but that's a good size to carry.
Not so much. But then again, Costa Rica is pretty dense.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to cover in Costa Rica.
Yeah, sure.
Let's see here. In terms of Sabone. There's
under 10, but like 7 or 8.
See, here's Sabone Anialatus, Sabone Anthracops, Sabone Argus, Sabone Dimidatius, Dimidiatus.
I give you applause, man. Yeah, you got it.
Sabone Lamari, Sabone Longifrenus, Sabone Nebulatus, and that's it. So that's what, 7, 8?
7, 8, yeah, about the same, I said. Okay. I mean, and you have to think, you know, these, they obviously have to niche partition in some fashion. You know, they can't, I mean, it's tropical rainforest, so it's specios, but you can't imagine them going after the exact same prey, or, you know, it'd be competition. So,
yeah,
it'd be interesting how that sorts itself out.
And if you look in the range maps, a lot of them don't overlap with each other. And a lot of them have very fractured and mottled ranges.
So it's really only the clouded snow eater that's really like the king of the hill in terms of range.
Yeah, cloud is pretty much all over the place. models on the Atlantic slope are pretty widespread. But like the Costa Rican snow eater, which is Sabone Lamari, that's like one very isolated spot.
Okay. Maybe an endemic, probably.
Yeah. Red-ringed, which is the other species of Sabone I saw, which is Sabone Anialatus. Those are also pretty widespread on the Atlantic slope as well.
Did you have photos of that one?
I do. I had to pull them up, though.
Okay. I don't remember if I saw that, but that's cool, man. But yeah, obviously, these are small arboreal snakes, so you can't imagine them having big home ranges. So, I mean, from what you're telling me, it seems like they speciated just because, you know, they're in different parts of Costa Rica, in different zones.
Yeah, some are more Pacific slope side, some more Atlantic slope side. Some are only found like the northern part, some are only found in the southern corners. So,
and then some are generous, like, you know, Nebulatus.
Yeah, which seems to have worked out very well for Nebulatus.
Yes.
But I mean, speaking of their names, their common name, so snail eaters, that's because they actually, I can't remember, do they have like a specially adapted skull and jaws for like digging snails out shells? Am I correct on that?
Yeah, lower jaw. I think you're right. Specialized, I guess, teeth to pull them out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. Yeah. So there's the red ring. That's the annulatus. Oh, you're muted. So.
Oh, my bad. Yeah, I mean, if you could zoom in on like the pupil, my goodness, that's amazing look.
Yeah. So. But yeah, if you, that's actually one of the big things about.
Wow.
These guys is their pupils are more red, where it's, you know, longer front is, at least the ones I saw were greenish colored pupils.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
I mean, they do look similar for sure. Yeah, that's a crazy looking eye.
Yeah. Let's see if I can find.
I mean, which one has the smaller range, longer frontis or this guy?
They're almost identical, but annulatus seems to have a bit of a, at least in Costa Rica, but annulatus seems to have a bit of a northern pocket. Let's see here. So longifrontis, the model, that's on the Atlantic slope from eastern Honduras to western Panama, from near sea level to like 2,600-2,700 feet elevation. And then red rings are also from eastern Honduras southward to eastern Panama. It also occurs on the Pacific slope of central and eastern Panama from near sea level to 5,500 feet. So a lot higher, gets to a lot higher elevation.
Okay. Yeah, and that's how you kind of differentiate the niche partition.
Yeah. I mean, they might go after different species of snails.
Yeah, as well. I mean, in the tropics, snail diversity kind of booms.
Yeah. Because it might be kind of slight, but if I can get a picture back of the annulatus, it looks, the longifrontis, I mean, their heads almost look a bit more pointed and gracile compared to
annulatus.
Yeah. That's just, I have a lot of photos. I probably should have organized all the Sabone photos into one file.
Dude, I'm waiting for you, like, your latest post, man. Come on.
And I think I'll do the Halloween snake next.
Oh, those are cool, yeah.
But let's see.
Are those dipsatids too?
Yeah, their genus is Oxyropus.
Okay, yeah. For a loop.
Yeah, Oxyropus petola. Okay. So.
Cool. I mean, yeah. South America is really the home of dipsatids. Diversity.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, if you see on that longifrontis, it has maybe a bit more, I would say, gracile of a snout look like. At least when you zoom in on it.
Angular as well, and a little pointed.
Yeah, that's probably a better way of saying it. It's more pointed, whereas the annulatus is almost blunt nose in comparison.
Yeah, it is. Like, it definitely. I mean, yeah, in the photos, you illustrate it beautifully, so for sure.
Yeah, but also.
I do like the longifrontis. I think I'm a fan of them.
Yeah, they are pretty cool. I also like how their belly coloration is that green coloration they have in their belly.
Yeah. You showed us photos last time. Yeah. Unreal coloration.
Yeah, but like I said, their eyes are different colored as well. That's kind of what gave the annulatus away when we spotted it.
Mm. But yeah, I can imagine how that thing just disappears in its environment.
Yeah, and I can't remember if I read this about these guys or another species. It might have been another species, but they might actually climb up higher into the canopy during the day to spend the day.
Yeah, I could see that. Makes sense. I mean, it's a scary place for a small arboreal snake, so any nook and crannies, be helpful.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, are we good on Sabone? Do you have anything else? Like I said, I don't know if I had anything in my Google Doc, but I mean, I kind of shared my spiel of, you know, Nebulotis being Creeble fodder. So we can move on to maybe Imatodes or Leptodira, the cat eyes.
Yeah. Let's go with the Imatodes, the vine snakes. So unfortunately, I did not take photos of the banded bloodheads because at the time I thought it was the same as the other bloodheads I saw, the common bloodheads. So I might have to Google a photo of bandits.
Oh, you did see one, but you just didn't take a photo.
Yeah, it was all the way up in Santa Rosa. It was crossing the road at night.
Okay.
So it was actually on the ground.
Not even a phone pic? Come on, Nate.
In my defense, I thought it was just another common. So I thought sure. I was going to save a little phone data space and not take a picture of a snake. I already thought I had pictures of, but looking back through the book, I was like, oh, wait, commons don't even make it anywhere near Santa Rosa. So.
Oh, Nate.
I know. But shame.
Still, though, cool, man. Cool. You got to see two Imatodes.
Yeah.
They're neat. Yeah, pull it up.
Let's see here. Ooh. Sorry, sound like Mark Norman on an episode of Save Our Parks.
I don't know who that is. you have to show me. But they're cool, man. I mean, we already discussed their diet, mainly lizard eaters.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at the picture, it's like, oh, gee, I wonder how they got that name. So, but yeah. Very, very blunt head.
Yeah, I'm sensing a trend with Imatodes and Sibone. Yeah. Kind of similar.
Yeah, like, well, they are both arboreal neotropical dipsatids. So, granted, yeah. Imatodes is more lizard focused than Sibone is.
Yeah, and with Nebulotis, you could probably elaborate. They have pretty big heads. Like, they're blunt headed as well, but their heads are pretty proportionally big.
Oh yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're bobbleheads.
See here,
and then I liked how you had the frontal view of that guy where he just looks so goofy with his bulging eyes.
Yeah,
you know, because these guys, you know, for their size, they have pretty big eyes, so they rely on it somehow, their vision. But you know, very nocturnal, a lot of these arboreal dipsatids.
Yeah, let's see here. But here's a really good picture of a banded. So yeah, you see this pattern is a lot stronger in these guys, whereas other ones it looks more like triangular, almost diamond like saddles.
But you know, I can't see how you would like misinterpret and be like, oh, it's just another one, because you know, very similar looking.
Yeah, so bandits, that's Imatodes. Gemistratus. That's his Gemistratus. Try saying that five times fast.
We'll go with that. That's good.
And then commons, that's Senchoa.
Okay. Oh, so I'm curious. I would think the common bloodhead is probably more common than this guy, like in terms of like the Costa Rican range.
Let me pull them up.
I mean, they range pretty far. I mean, if I found it in Panama, I would imagine they go pretty far.
Yeah. Yeah. Commons are pretty much all over the Atlantic slope and onto this like southern and central Pacific coast to Costa Rica.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's from like southern Tamaulipas and Oaxaca to Argentina, along both slopes from near sea level to 5,200 feet.
For the same species?
Common.
Jeez, man. That is super broad.
Basically, the entire Amazon all the way down to Argentina.
Yeah. God, yeah.
And then Gemistratus, the bandits, They are on the Pacific slope from southern Mexico to southern Colombia. They also occur locally on the Atlantic slope in northern Guatemala, Honduras, and Costa Rica. And they can be found all the way from sea level to 4,700 feet.
Not bad, not bad.
Nowhere near as widespread as the common.
No, but in that case, it makes it a bit more novel finding it. So, but
there was one species of blunthead I didn't see, and that would have been one of the coolest to see, and that's the yellow-headed blunt snake, which is Imitotes inornatus, which, let's see if that picture comes up.
It shows, yeah. Whoa, looks like a big one.
Well, I mean, on the photo, it probably does, but...
I mean, it had like a pretty big head, and it looked like it's probably like a big species of Imitotes. I don't know.
Yeah.
Still, man, that's good, man. More than me. I mean, that's more than me. That's fantastic to see two examples.
Have you seen Cenchoa in the wild?
What's that one?
That's the common
one. Yes, yeah. In Panama, that's the common one, yeah.
I was gonna say they're also found in Oaxaca, so.
Well, actually I did find a DOR specimen. I don't think it was chinchilla. I think it was probably a different species because it was very vibrantly orange and yeah, it was a different species for sure, but I forgot about that. You reignited a memory of a dead snake. Thanks, Nate.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the two light billed, blunt headed arboreal dipsadids genre that I saw.
Into like a heavier, slightly heavier build, but still quite arboreal dipsadid. The cat eyes.
Leptodyra.
Leptodyra. So this is a specios genre. I think globally, I mean, you know, they don't cover the world, but I think there's like 16 plus species. And then in Costa Rica in particular, there's like 5. And then in Panama, there's like 4. So
yeah. You might be right, but I'm trying to remember the exact species count. I only saw one species, which by my estimation is the northern cat eye. So that's Leptodyra septentrionalis. Septentrionalis. Let's go with that. Septentrionalis.
Let's go with that. But that's where it gets kind of funny because there's like the ornate and then there's the rhombic. So rhombifera and then there's ornata. So, you know, cat eye taxonomy is kind of fickle in that sense.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
But there he is. That was the one I saw on the first night.
Yeah, I love how that gallant dude is just head flaring for you. It looks awesome. Makes it look like a viper.
Yeah, so the one I was kind of curious and confused about was he could be a common cat eye, which is Leptodyra rhombifera, but the range doesn't quite match up and the patterning is not quite there on this guy, at least in my book, compared to the Northerns.
Sure. I mean, I didn't see it, so I'll just take your best judgment. But I would say I think it was like the most common ones were Ornata and Rhombifera. They're the most commonly observed.
Yeah, it's a total of 4 species of Leptodyra in Costa Rica. So
yeah, so I think it varies depending on who you talk to. Yeah. But they do well in Costa Rica. I mean, they've established themselves well.
Yeah. But this found in Arenal. So on the Arenal Lodge property. And that's why I'm leaning towards Northern, because that's where Northerns are. And I think it's what might sell it is this neck pattern in that with commons, it's often attaches to the first blotch on the back.
Okay. Well, okay. Sure.
How I read it. Yeah. So.
And so that's a big geographical range too, because aren't they in the southern tip of Texas?
Let's see here.
I think that's the same species. Yeah.
Ranging from southern Texas to Peru.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's another biggie. Another one with a big range.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there'll be more splits as the time passes with that genre especially. But but they're cool snakes, man. I mean, rear fanged as well. And, you know, some of these guys in the genre, so I you know, from reports are actually pretty, pretty bad.
Yeah. Fortunately, we didn't get bit by this guy, even though we gave him plenty of reasons to, for him to bite us. We basically saw his belly scale through the tree limbs, like 15 feet off the ground. So we basically climbed up to bend and shake that branch down far enough for us to yank him out of it. So you can understand why he's flaring his neck out for us.
But I mean, that's all it's doing. I mean, what a nice snake. And like you guys held it, obviously, right? But like
a little bit, yeah.
What was it doing? Was it just like cruising? Like was it moving constantly, or was it like pausing?
We actually managed to get him to sit still on a branch.
Okay, that's not common at all for cat-eyed snakes. For all you guys out there, they are they're always on the go at night. They don't stop.
Yeah, I think it might have had something to do with the fact that we kind of, I don't know, jarred him awake out of nowhere.
Yeah,
it's probably just shell shock.
Yeah, still recovering from PTSD.
Yeah, gave him a serpentine shell shock.
I like that. I'll use that. That's a good one. But yeah, no, cool snake, and you know, it was kind of biggish, right? Like 2.5-3 feet.
Yeah, he was a fairly decent sized one as well.
Yeah, it's cool. There another one I've seen. So, ooh, we got video. Let's see this instead. This is cool. It did post nicely for you guys.
Yeah. So.
Hmm.
That's the one hard part about photographing snakes is sometimes they're so thin the camera doesn't recognize what the focus point is supposed to be. So,
yeah, but when it's flaring and set like that, that helps a little bit.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Yeah, that was a great pose for the snake, and yeah, it showed the body, the profile beautifully. So I was going to touch on there another genre I've encountered in my travels in Panama and in Mexico. And they're really neat snakes, you know. For the most part, they're relatively abundant and common because, you know, they're mainly amphibian eaters.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, I mean, they're also, speaking of amphibians, one of their favorite foods is frog eggs or boiled frog eggs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you guys out there have seen, like, nature documentaries, there's segments where they, you know, they show, like, cat-eye snakes eating, like I guess glass frogs or whatever tropical frog,
red eye tree frog,
yeah, whatever tropical frog species, and they're literally just gobbling these frogs eggs.
Yeah, it's probably like jello shots for them.
Big jello shots, you know. But was that the only cat eye you saw?
We saw another one. We saw a total of two more. One was, and both of them were like the night after. Mm-hmm. One was when we were hiking. We saw them in on some like I guess palm leaves is best. It's probably not the palm leaves, not the most accurate description, but
mm-hmm.
But yes, some a big broadleaf tropical plant. I'm sorry, I'm not a plant person, but, but yeah, that botanist. Was him.
Shame him, botanist.
Yeah, but that's him right there.
Oh, cute.
A lot smaller than the big one we saw the first night, and then later that night we were hiking back so the lodge has a lot of different buildings on its property, and mm-hmm. walking past another housing unit they have there, and there was another cat eye on the ground just looking up, starting to go up the wall after a little anole or gecko on the side of the wall. So
yeah, man, once darkness falls they will come for sure.
Yeah,
that's neat, man. Yeah, they're cool snakes. I don't know how many species I've seen. Maybe just a handful. I think 3 or 4. I only seen one in Panama. They were all relatively small. I think they were the northerns as well. One thing I jotted in my Google Doc was I'm trying to refresh. What was it? So I think Rhombifera. Ophiophagy. Like it ate another snake, a parrot snake. So apparently some of these species are kind of broad in their diet.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. For an arboreal snake, they're fairly decently heavy sized body.
Yeah. And I mean, depending on the species, their venom can pack a punch to, you know, their cold-blooded prey, which is mainly what they eat.
Okay. I found your note in your Google Doc. It's another note is of L. Rombifera enacting in necrophagy, eating fragments of carrion of prey that wasn't killed by the predator with a broken off iguana tail.
Yeah. So some biologists in Panama, actually, they noted that they found a dead Rombifera. And yeah, it had eaten like a frog and then also a broken off iguana tail. And like, this is like, you know, iguanas are big sized lizards. So the snake obviously didn't eat all of the iguana, just the fragmented off tail.
Yeah.
You know,
so that's a very rare behavior in snakes when you think about it. Now, the only other snake I can think of that would do something similar to that is maybe a cottonmouth. So,
yeah. If you go to Everglades, it's a very common occurrence you'll see of them eating crow kill snakes or frogs or whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other genre of Dipstatus I saw the most of in terms of species, and that's a total of two species, was Geophis. So that's the earth snakes.
That's crazy that they're Dipstatus too, man. I'm getting schooled. But yeah.
Again, I'm just going off what the book says. So.
Yeah, I mean, I believe it. I don't know. Earth snakes, though. Very, I mean, as their name illustrates, they're typically small fossorial snakes.
Yeah. And the first one we saw was the Costa Rican earth snake, which is Geophis brachycephalus. Now, if you know your scientific prefixes and suffixes, which I had learned in high school, brachycephalus pretty easily translates to flathead, which if you look at this guy, you can see he does have a fairly flat head.
I'm trying to think what it reminds me of. Kind of reminds me kind of a, like a sunbeam snake. Or like a,
oh, that's a really good comparison now that I think about it.
Sunbeam or a little bit worm snakey, but sunbeam is pretty good.
Yeah.
But that's an outstanding looking species. That's, I mean, black and red, you can't beat.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to beat black and red. And also, if you look, it also has a bit of a white belly as well.
Yeah, and it comes up quite a bit on the side. Huh. So how little or how big was this guy? You know, like size of your palm or
easily fit in the palm of my hand. So
okay, yeah, they're not all terribly big, but that's cool, man.
And then the other species we saw was the common or Hoffman's earth snake, which is Geophis hoffmanni. Let's see if I can
find. And that one was a bit more not drab, but it was kind of a bit more basic in terms of like coloring.
Yeah, it doesn't have anywhere near the pattern breakup. So basically imagine
it to it, right? Like in that video, it had a good like sheen to it, huh?
Yeah, it was very shiny, very iridescent looking. Mm-hmm. I'll see if I can find a picture of him, which would be, I believe it's this. Yeah, here we go.
But it's funny, you know, South America, they have their earth snakes, and up here we have our earth snakes.
Yeah. But yeah, here he is. This is the Hoffman's. So this is the one I managed to snag before I got too close to the sun. I touched him and caused him to literally throw himself off the road.
Just coral snake it.
He would make for a very athletic coral snake, I'll say that. He literally went airborne a few times.
Yeah, so, okay, that's athletic.
Yeah, but yeah, even on this guy, you can kind of see a bit of white for the underbelly. So,
yeah, I mean that sheen just kind of takes over it, but yeah, I see it. Very neat, man. And like, I'm assuming insectivorous, like just earthworms and stuff like that.
Ant larvae, that sort of stuff, from what I've read. And you just look at how they're built. They look like something built to eat really small subterranean insects.
Yeah, and, you know, with these fossorial snakes, they can't open their jaws that wide, you know, so they're kind of gape limited, and it's a bug's life in hell if you're experiencing predators like that.
Yeah. And the crazy thing was, we had not walked more than like a few, like 2 minutes down the trail from after we saw the Costa Rican, when we saw his natural predator, the Costa Rican coral snake, which is Macursus muscitensis, I believe, going off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, point blank, that's pretty cool to see the prey and predator.
Yeah. So I don't think he was hunting him because it was too much distance between the two, in my opinion. But that coral snake was definitely out and about for a little snacky snack.
Mm-hmm. A little sneaky snack, for yeah. Sure.
Yeah, so that's the Geophis.
Very neat. We got Geophis up the way.
Okay, we only have two genre of Dipsatis left to go, and that's the coffee snake and the Halloween snake.
Woo, woo, let's do it. Coffee snake. I'm really less versed with those. I only seen one in Panama. It was very fleeting. But again, they're another genre of small snakes, right? For the most part.
Yeah. They do look, they're also very small. But this is the red coffee snake, which is Nenia sabaea.
So. I don't know, man. They're kind of like the South American equivalent of our tantilla, of our flat-headed snakes.
They do look a lot like tantilla. Now, well, actually, I wouldn't be surprised if tantilla is also in Costa Rica.
Well, tantilla is a big genre, too. They range all the way down to South America.
Yeah, so let's see if I can.
And they get more colorful, which is a shame. I mean, we got plenty of tantilla in the States, but, you know, they get way more colorful once you hit the neotropics and tropics.
Yeah. So I think part of the reason they're called coffee snakes is because they're also often found, like, plantations, stuff like that. So I guess they're often found on, you know, coffee plantations, hence the name.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. But yeah, they're cute little snakes, man.
And apparently, they actually benefit from forest clearing for more open, broken up habitat.
So they're one that benefits from, like, you know, man-made alteration.
Yeah, like agriculture and stuff like that. Or, well, maybe not agriculture, but like orchards and stuff like that.
Yeah. Nice. That's a positive spin on it.
But so I do like how they have that yellow outlining of the two black stripes.
Yeah, I should have double checked, but like I told you last time, it reminds me of like the juvenile Musaranas. Like I think a few South American Dipsatids, when they're young, they kind of look like coffee snakes. But I need to get back with that and see if that's valid.
Yeah, that's.
And you saw you said you saw two species or just one of these?
Just the one species, but we saw like two or three individuals of coffee snake.
Okay.
So, but yeah, these guys are also predominantly insect eaters, but they'll have to eat on the surface, but also eat inside insect burrows from what I'm reading. One individual reportedly consumed a small Sicilian, so.
Okay. I guess Sicilians do start out small too, but wow. It's interesting. Prey item.
Yeah. And the thing is, when these guys feel threatened, they actually flatten their bodies out really flat down to the ground. You can't really see in this picture, but they make themselves look flat. They pancake like crazy.
What happened? I lost you. Well, if we're still recording, it's just me, you guys. Thanks for sticking with us. but yeah, so it was very fleeting, my experience with a coffee snake species in Panama. I was actually with a group of, I want to say biologists, just a group of naturalists at the that were a part of the Smithsonian Institution that's based in Panama City. And yeah, we were just at a national park, and you know, mind you, I never met any of these folks, but it was so nice and refreshing to see that they were just so all into just nature in every aspect, like even a little snake, like, know, you'd be surprised. Even a little snake, people will shriek or scream, but no, they were like, "Oh, cool, look, a snake." Because the main guy, Alex, kind of told everybody that I was joining and how I was, you know, big into amphibians and reptiles. Surprisingly, that was the only snake that night. We got plenty of amphibians, plenty of toads and frogs, but that was the only snake. Oh, one nice capture was a sleeping basilisk lizard. It was a decent size, juvenile, was still small, but decent size. That was cool to sneak up on. And like the grand finale at the end were two American crocs, you know, cutest. That was awesome. But I don't want to spiel that story too much. I can touch on it another day. But let's see what's going on. I don't know if he
Sorry about the delay, folks. A little technical error on my part.
We're back in style.
See, we were talking about coffee snakes, as I recall.
Well, and in the meantime, grab the smoothie.
It's an efficient use of your time. Much more efficient than mine with just running around like crazy.
But we're back now. We're back to talk. Well, I mean, really, we're just recapping coffee snakes. I mean, we kind of got to the end of your experience and, you know, my brief encounter in Panama, but...
Yeah. Oh, I was talking about how they really flatten themselves out.
Mm.
See if we can... I might have a picture of them really flattening themselves out on the ground. Might not. Double check.
And what? Is this like a two-folded thing where it's used for, like, basking and then also defensiveness?
I think it's more defensive behavior from what I've seen.
Hmm.
Where I think they just try and make themselves as low to the ground as possible. So,
I mean, that's what you see with the cage snakes. Yeah. Not like most nature scenes and whatnot. I know these aren't nature scenes, but very similar with the cage.
Yeah. But you can see it more on like his lateral portion of his body, how it kind of,
yeah, you definitely can tell.
Widens out.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Wow.
I can tell you from experience that when they do flatten out like that, it does make them a bit more difficult to pick off the road. So,
oh, sure. Yeah, probably slick kind of hugs the ground a bit more.
Yeah, extra traction. All right, and that leaves one last species of dipsadid that I saw down there. All the rest were either the lapids, vipers, or colubrids.
Or boas.
Or boas, fair enough. Thanks for reminding me. How could I forget? All right, but that would be Oxyropus petula, which is the Halloween snake. I've also heard it called the Harlequin snake or the Forest Flame snake. In fact,
I can see reason for all those names. Yeah.
If you type into Google Forest Flame, that snake, that's what pops up. So
beautiful.
And this guy's, and the thing is, this guy's only like partially grown. He's like halfway grown, so his coloration is still fully developed. So when they're younger like this, they have a lot more bland coloration, patterning, and stuff like that. As you can see, kind of the interior portion of his body is a lot lighter, more white coloration. But we did see one DOR full-grown adult, and he was a big one too. And he really had that bright coloration. Let me see if I can find a picture of him. But it was a crying shame that he was a DOR because he was a beauty. So.
Was that after or before you found that live one?
This was before, actually. So, yeah. But for those of you who have a squeamish stomach, look away because he was fairly well splattered out, and at least his rear third was. So,
you've been warned.
Yeah,
oh, that's not too bad.
Yeah, but it, like I said, when they're more full grown, the coloration kind of matures and comes more solid. So that like very pale white turns into more solid reds towards the front of the body.
Yeah, it becomes a bit more, I guess, bicolored, you know, bicolored.
Yeah.
Huh. Too bad. But they are very neat snakes. You know, they're also quite common in species, I think, that genre.
Yeah, see. I will say a nice thing about this book, it both organizes both by families level. So It has the Dipsadas all in one cluster, one set of pages. The Colubris have their own section. And then to flip through it, it's actually organized by genus alphabetically. So you actually flip through. So like right now I'm at Imantoides.
Mm-hmm.
And keep flipping through. Leptodeira, Nenea, Nothophis, Oxyropus. Here we go. So, see here. So, Oxyropus, Patola ranges from southern Mexico to Bolivia and northern Brazil. So, another very wide range species.
Yeah, apparently. But that's very handy and very organized. Side tangent. Also, there's going to be new California field guide out.
By Robert Hansen?
Next May, right? Next summer.
I pre-ordered that, so.
Dude, I mean, yes, it's such a great price point. Like, I'd be so excited for it.
Yeah. But, yeah, you see that's the juvenile. So how much paler the red is, almost like a very light coral pink on the juveniles.
Yeah.
And transitions to more brighter, almost coral snake red.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's see here.
Is that the only Oxyropus in Costa?
It looks like it. I have to look up how specious Oxyropus is. And see if there's other species, which, given how wide a range that thing has, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest.
Yeah, I think there's a few. I don't know how many off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But are they rear-fanged as well? Do you know, or?
Well, they're Dipsadas, so they probably are rear-fanged. Okay, there's like 15 members of the genus. It's 15 species.
Yeah, that's a good sample. Sample size.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, very neat. I would say out of maybe most of the Dipsadids, that's the one that most people would like to see and that maybe isn't frequently encountered.
Yeah. I mean, I might be a bit of an oddball in that I would have really loved to see a false fertilance, you know, Xenodon.
Dude, no, dude, 100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Let's see here. You know, I'm just going to make a note for future streams. If we ever want to show photos, we should just organize all the photos like the day before. So it's a lot easier and quicker to go through them.
I agree. I'll make note of that.
But let's see here. Actually, there might have been one I forgot that. Hold on. I don't know. I was thinking the false tree coral was. Yeah, it's a colubrid. So. But. Oh, well. Okay. Let's see here.
We do not hate on colubrids, folks. But this is just a Dipsadid show for the most part.
Costa Rican Dipsadids. Yeah. But. Yeah, Dipsadas are very prevalent in Costa Rica, and especially in South America, which makes sense considering that's like they're basically where they're most diverse.
I mean, that was like their original radiation, right? Something like that.
You know, the funny thing is, I read in, you know, Loffman's book that it might have been like the Himalayas might have been their origin point. But
you know what? Yeah, he did touch on that. It's been a while since I read his book.
I don't buy that though. I think it's just one random offshoot radiation. That's my personal theory on it.
I mean, you have to take into account like how long ago was it when, you know, Dipsadid split off and became their own thing. Like, was it like 80, 70? Wasn't it around there, like 70 million?
I'd have to read up on it, but I don't know. It sounds a little further back than I was thinking. I was thinking probably somewhere during the Cenozoic is when a lot of snake diversification happened. So okay, maybe like 30, I would say, 20 sure. to 30. But I'm no expert on the subject. I'm not even well read on that subject. I would love to have, if there's any snake paleontologists listening, feel free to reach out. I'd love to have you either here or Crocast. I would love to talk to a snake paleontologist. So, or yeah, evolutionary biologist.
Yeah, you've had plenty of croc associated people. Now it's time for a little bit of snake love. Just a little bit.
Hey, I've had plenty of snake people on as well.
I know.
Well, speaking of crocs, you see Smitty's making Temistema merch. I see he's in the process of making Temistema
merch. No, at all. No.
I am so looking forward to that. I started messaging him saying, as soon as that is in stock, message me. I need to know that variant, so I need to get some.
I'm so glad you told me, because now I'm going to have my eyes peeled open for that. I love Temistema. You know, that's something we share. Temistema is awesome forever.
Yeah. So, in case you guys are wondering, Smitty or Justin Smith, he's the one of the hosts of both Sticks and Stogies and the Herpetoculture Podcast. He's basically the guy behind the Herpetoculture Network. Yeah. He also has Fulvius Apparel, which is it's undisputedly the best reptile apparel / clothing company
out there. It's up there. It's up there.
I can't think of anyone who really competes with him. So,
no, neither can I.
So,
but yeah, give like follow. Look at his shop. You'll be impressed.
Yeah. Does that? Hey, Smitty. Does that mean we get a free discount? A little bit of discount on the next order.
Sponsors.
Hey, maybe we could get some Reptile Rambling shirts made.
That should be in the works. That'd be nice.
Yeah. Yeah, but going back to the Tuan Leander's book, each family has their own little, you know, preface page.
Yeah.
So, and oftentimes, at least with the lizards, the genuses, like the more diverse genuses, will also have a bit of a preface page as well.
I like that, man. So, like I said, I never got the book myself, but I'm glad that you grabbed it, and it was a good grab.
Yeah. And I have to go through the amphibian. I also got the amphibian book, and I have to go through that because there are so many indescript little frogs and toads.
Yeah.
That probably take a good full day. Well, maybe not a full day, but a full afternoon of studying just to check off every little box on what all the frogs I took pictures of.
Yeah, amphibian diversity in the Neotropics and tropics is mind-numbing, to say the least.
Yeah.
In a good way, but it's a lot. It's a lot of nondescript brown frogs.
Yeah. But they all deserve love.
Yeah, they do.
On that note, is there anything else you want to talk about? Any other reptilian rambling?
No, man. We rambled on quite a bit. This was a good show. I'm glad we got kind of heavy in the Dipsadids, and you know, we could relate on both fronts from your recent trip and then from my recent travels, and just talk about them. You know, they're a group of snake that don't really get much spotlighting as it is.
Yeah.
You know, so it's good to touch on. So hopefully everybody found this interesting, real fascinating. It's always good to look at photos again. You know, I'm a big photo guy. So if you guys are just listening, please hop on in on the YouTube and just give us a watch. Plenty of nice photos from yours truly.
All right. And with that, thanks for joining us.
We'll see you.
All right.
But yeah, so I got with Johnny.